Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thank you for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, February 24th. This morning, we talk about the constitutionality of President Donald Trump's executive orders. We check in with an interfaith prayer for peace. The start of Ramadan is just around the corner. How is the Muslim community reacting to the early days of the Trump administration? A former attorney general remembers his fight against Trump's Muslim ban. Plus, the flight of high school newspapers struggling to gain student interest and stay alive. How might the decline in student journalism affect everyone in the long run? And did you hear there's a new species of bee? We talked to the scientists who brought the discovery to light. What makes Hawaii so different when it comes to identifying new insects? You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. These are certainly trying times for the soul. The headlines are pushing many of us to the limits, emotionally and mentally, as President Donald Trump issues executive order after executive order in an effort to downsize the federal government and cut waste. But the number of legal challenges that have been filed is unprecedented. To help us unpack what we're seeing happen around us, we turn to Avi Sofer. He's the former dean of the University of Hawaii William Richardson School of Law. His specialty is constitutional law. We reached out to get some context on the many lawsuits filed over actions taken by President Trump and Elon Musk, the head of the administration's Department of Government Efficiency.
This is an extremely scary time, and the rule of law is a cliche, and it means different things to different people. But these people, particularly our co-president Musk and his chainsaw, and the president really don't care about the rule of law, and they say so. There was a very important decision issued by a fairly new federal judge in Maryland on Friday, and it was saying you can't go ahead with all this DEI stuff. There are serious constitutional issues. He is a star as a student, as a lawyer, and now a newly appointed judge. And he talks about constitutional problems with the DEI stuff, and he's absolutely right about that. So the next day, on X, Musk says, impeach. I mean, you can't impeach every judge who comes out with a decision you don't like and still say you have any respect for the law, because judges interpret the law. And you're not entitled to interpret the law yourself. To some extent, of course, we all do that. But if you're in a position of power in particular, it is really dangerous if you say, I am above the law. Or if you're saving the nation, the law doesn't matter, which is paraphrasing what the president said, in turn paraphrasing Napoleon.
And when this country was formed, you know, there were checks and balances by design. And it just seems very painful to see that, you know, that system isn't quite working, that there's a lot of overreach right now with the executive branch. And we want those checks and balances to work. But, you know, there seems to be this silence from Congress.
Absolutely. And it's really very concerning that Congress doesn't care about its prerogatives, and it doesn't seem a narrow majority in the House. They just don't seem at all concerned, or they seem so scared that they will be primaried that they go along. And this is not the Congress we've known, certainly throughout my lifetime. They were concerned about their prerogatives, as they ought to be. That's not always good. I mean, often they were gridlocked. Often they slowed things down too much. But you do want checks and balances, and the framers certainly put that in. And to say, in response, as the president has said, and as Musk certainly seems to believe, that just doesn't matter. The president is unitary. It's a unitary power. The executive can do whatever the executive wants to do. And that is exactly counter to what the Constitution does, what the Constitutional Convention discussed, and what the revolution actually was about. It was about the king, King George. They didn't like unitary executives. There's no historical support. There's no precedential support in terms of prior decisions by the Supreme Court. There is one which is recent by the Chief Justice about the presidential immunity, and there are a couple of others where you can say, well, there's something in some of these cases that gives the president more authority. But it's against the precedents of Nixon turning over the tapes, of Harry Truman during the Korean War saying, we need the steel mills running, and I'm going to take them, although I'm going to allow them to operate just as they were, but I want to make sure that we have those under control. And the Supreme Court, many of them appointed by Roosevelt and some by Truman, said, no, that's unconstitutional. You cannot do that. So in the face of history, in the face of precedent, And I've got to say, in the face of the constitutional text, it says that the president is supposed to see that the laws are faithfully executed. The laws are faithfully executed, not I will execute the laws.
Well, over the weekend, there was a really good article that was published by the New York Times, which attempted to track the lawsuits against President Trump's agenda. And I think that it mentioned that 29 of those rulings were paused just because people have taken this to court to try and figure out, did President Trump go too far? Did Elon Musk go too far? And the lament that I'm hearing is that, yes, unfortunately, going through the legal system is just going to take time.
Well, that is a legitimate concern, and the law seldom catches up with the events. And even at any deliberative body, I mean, even a Congress or a legislature in a state takes some time. They don't just announce the law, and that's what we want. They may take too much time. As I said, they may be gridlocked, but courts can act fairly quickly. On the other hand, it was Steve Bannon, I think, who emphasized that you can flood the zone. If you have so much going on that nobody can keep track of it, and you have lawsuits all over the place, nobody's quite sure where the law stands, which thing were they challenging, who's the one challenging it, and so on. And that can work. Unfortunately, that can work with particular effect in our change time of technology and social media. Because you can just say, well, we're waiting for the Court of Appeals, or we're waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court. And all these cases are not going to be consolidated. So it is true that you can appeal what a federal district court judge does, as Judge Abelson did in Maryland. So you give it time for the appeal, and the Supreme Court can grab it if they want to, which, by the way, they did in the Steele seizure case. They took it. That was decided in record time or close to record time. You can decide as the Supreme Court to grab a case and decide it overnight, practically. And our state Supreme Court just showed that they could decide a major case about the insurance companies and Maui, not overnight, but very quickly. That can happen. But that takes the Supreme Court you want to get to. And I'm not so sure we can count on our current Supreme Court to enforce the guardrails. That presidential immunity decision really has no support. And yet there was the Chief Justice writing it on the last day of the term, and he had a majority.
Well, you know, in the New York Times article, I know they've tried to lay out as best they could things that were within President Trump's powers and then things that they believe were an overreach and were being decided on by the courts. You know, everything from the budget freezes to the firing of the civil servants. I think the last big brouhaha was over the memo that Elon Musk sent out to all government employees asking them, you know, what did you do for us lately? What did you do last week? And failure to respond, you know, means automatic termination. And lots of people are saying, hold on, not so fast, you know, because there are collective bargaining laws, there are labor laws. So I don't know, what do you make of that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. It is clearly something he, whoever he is, the co-president or the president or some other advisors, they just don't have the authority to do this. But it will take, it scares people, it's cruel, it makes people certainly less effective as employees if they're wondering what's going to happen. And I think it's striking that some of the recent appointees in FBI head, Defense Department, have said to their people, you don't have to abide by this. So that's part of the chaos that I think Steve Bannon pointed to. But it also says sometimes even Trump people who are loyal supporters and perhaps not qualified for those positions have reasons to say to their employees, this doesn't apply to you. There's no exception in what Musk sent out, and it's outrageous. I mean, there is no authority for it. And there are civil service protections. There's a reason we have civil service protection. It was a bane of the existence of presidents, including Abraham Lincoln, that while the war was going on, civil war is on, he was, of course, very much involved in losing for a long time. The North was not in good shape. He still had to see office seekers for much of his day, because that's what you could do in those days. I'm somebody's cousin, and I'd like to be in the post office or something like that. So the civil service reacted to partisan, very partisan, political favors. And that was the problem, and it's written out, and it's all in writing. But if you don't care what's in writing, because you say, I am the law, then you have a poor argument about what democracy is about. And one of the things that I think is important to recognize is, as the courts are slow, the courthouse itself can be a bully pulpit. So people are making their points in reaction to what's going on in Washington right now, in the streets and in their speeches and in teach-ins. And that's important, too. And in fact, the inside, the lawyers and those who are involved in the courts need the outside protest and vice versa. They can point to the other and say, look, there is something abroad in the land that really matters.
What do you make of the removal of the eight inspector generals, you know, and then also the removal of the JAG attorneys?
It's a terrible sign that they don't care about the law. The law clearly protects the inspector general, and JAG officers' role, and they're very impressive people for the most part. I mean, not all of them, but they really are very impressive. And their role is to say to a general or an admiral or whatever, you can't do that. That's against the law. And that sometimes is about war crimes. You can't do that. And our new Secretary of Defense is down on people who committed war crimes being charged. And so he wants them pardoned. I mean, this is a shocking thing in itself. But compared to what the other things are going on, it kind of fits the pattern. We don't want anyone saying no. We want to do what we want to do. As my spouse, Marlene Booth, who makes documentary films, said, this is like Animal House. I mean, it is, hey, the boys are having fun. I got a chainsaw. I mean, it really is pretty appalling, if not disgusting, to think that they're having a good time. They're reinforcing each other, and they don't care about outside pressures, criticism, or, I think, at a basic level, the law.
Anything else you think is important to underscore as we try and navigate through these times and wait for the courts to decide on these various cases?
Well, I don't want to be taken to be saying you always follow the law, all laws are just. I'm not saying that at all. But it's a system in which there are ways you can challenge the law within the system. And it sometimes needs challenging out in demonstrations, in First Amendment protected expression. So I'm not saying blind obedience to the law. The law, the Soviet Union had laws and Hitler had laws. You don't always follow the law. That's sometimes the immoral thing to do. But you have to keep justice as part of the law. And there is precious little concern for justice in terms of the human beings involved and what matters to them in what's going on in Washington. So I think we have to treat each other as human beings and have a regard for justice. In some ways, it raises the stakes in doing that. And also, one of the checks and balances, not separation of powers, is federalism. So that's another way of saying things can go on in one place that don't go on in another. And places like Hawaii, I think, are different in many important ways. I think we're very lucky to be here, and I think we are lucky to have a very good judiciary. Now, some of these matters are way beyond their jurisdiction. Nevertheless, it can help us deal with one another with justice if we have a good justice system here. So that's one way to find perhaps a shard of hope.
A shard of hope. That was Avi Sofer, a former law school dean at the University of Hawaii, talking to us about the latest legal challenges to President Trump's executive orders.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits offering workforce housing solutions for young Kama'aina training to become farmers, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Aloha, I'm Russell Subiono, the host of HPR's award-winning podcast, This Is Our Hawaii. We examine the legacy of large land ownership and how it impacts the community's sense of belonging. If you haven't checked it out yet, HPR is bringing it to you on the air for the first time, starting with episode 1 on Waipio Valley. And that's coming to you Sunday at 4 p.m. on HPR 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
This weekend at an event sponsored by the Interfaith Alliance Hawaii, a small group gathered at the Iwale Mosque of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of Hawaii.
يُسَبِّحُ لِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ الْمَلِكِ الْقُدُّوسِ الْعَزِيزِ الْحَكِيمِ.
Hashim Osman recently took over from the last imam of the Muslim group, who had been here in the islands for the last 7 years. We wondered how the community is feeling. It wasn't that long ago that Hawaii filed suit over a Muslim travel ban instituted by President Donald Trump during his first administration.
At this point, of course, people feel that they could be targeted both for being Muslim or if they are immigrants in the country. Even if they hold legal status, they still are worried of different ways that this can impact them and come back to them. So within our community as well, of course, there are people who are legal and who at times who are refugees, who have escaped violence, who have escaped religious persecution, and they have come into the United States seeking that religious freedom and seeking that protection and a peaceful life. And they are worried, of course, that something could be done, to come after them and to force them to leave the country and go back to wherever they were, where they were being persecuted or facing religious persecution. So this is a, condition at the moment.
That was Hashim Osman, the imam of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community of Hawaii, talking with us. Last month, the group held an event in our nation's capital to pray for world peace, and February marks the UN Interfaith World Harmony Month. This morning, we talked to former State Attorney General Doug Chin. He led the fight challenging the Muslim travel ban during the first Trump administration. He reflected on that pivotal time and shared his take on some of the legal challenges presented by the first 100 days of Trump's second administration.
Well, it was just about a week into the first Trump administration, and I remember that the Muslim travel ban was announced. Within just a couple days, there were hundreds of people, local Hawaii people, that were down at the Daniel K. Inouye International Airport protesting and offering their support for people who were coming into the country. And I think that's when it really hit me, at least when I was watching it on TV, how it was really, what was happening there was really striking a nerve with people here locally. And it's not necessarily because we have a very large Muslim population, although we do have a significant group of people who are of the Muslim faith. Yet the entire community, it really felt like, was rallying around this group. And I think largely because there was this sense of, hey, if the government is going to start attacking one group because of their religion or because of their ethnicity, then what's going to stop them from coming after other groups? And this kind of reminds a lot of us of what our parents or our grandparents faced when they were, if they were of Japanese descent, when there were internment camps that happened during World War II, or other types of prejudice that perhaps even my parents faced when they came into the country as Chinese immigrants. So it really did strike a nerve. And I think that's when it hit all of us who were in public office at the time, including myself. Look, I got to do something. I got to try to stand up for what are the values that we all grew up with when we were born in this country.
Yeah, I think the feeling from the Muslim community is, people are wondering who's next.
Sure. And I think that's what affected so many of us who were hearing about it, was that, yeah, this was just talking about just travel. And I'm putting air quotes around that. But if that's what the government can do, or if that's what the government is trying to do, that sure seems to go against like the constitutional principles that so many of us learned when we were in social studies growing up or learning about the U.S. government. And so that's why we reacted the way we did.
And so for our listeners, remind us, what was the outcome of that and how long did it take for us to get to that point?
Sure. So what happened was pretty quickly we were able to obtain a restraining order from one of the federal U.S. district judges here, Derek Watson, that had a nationwide effect and essentially put a stop to the Muslim ban. The U.S. government then followed up with another version of it that was kind of dressed up and kind of had language around it that didn't exist before when it was just so obviously prejudicial. Yeah, I think we still questioned whether or not there was still a prejudicial impact behind what was being put forth in the new version. But eventually that new version was one that we were also able to stop until we got to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court at that time ruled 5-4 against Hawaii and its efforts to stop the Muslim ban. And so that final, I'd say, watered down version of the Muslim ban is what ended up going forward.
And there were a number of residents here who were immediately impacted by that travel ban, right?
Yes.
Folks who were trying to go see family,
right?
That kind of thing.
Right. And I think that's what became quite apparent is that if there was one community that was affected, it was actually the university. In other words, there were professors who weren't able to come back, or there was a law student who had actually been admitted to the law school who now was not going to be able to join and be part of and contributing to the legal community here, the law school community, simply because the travel ban would be affecting them. And so that's what we argued, that this unconstitutional order was injuring the people of Hawaii because, for example, the UH community wasn't able to benefit from having these people be part of the community as they could have been if they'd been receiving the constitutional protections that they should have been getting.
I don't know what your thoughts are as you see the numerous challenges that have been filed against President Trump's crazy number of executive orders that have been coming fast and furious.
Well, I think what's impressive to me is that everyone seems ready for this. In other words, people have known amongst the attorneys general who were concerned about the Trump administration, they've known that this was coming. And so their ability to be able to get to the courthouse, file a complaint, and get a judge to order that at least be temporarily slowed down or halted, that's been very impressive. I don't personally know how this is all going to play out as it eventually winds its way through a lawsuit. I think that's one of the things is that you can file a lawsuit and you can get a quick temporary restraining order to just put a pause on everything, which is important because then that allows maybe Congress or other people to be able to speak up and start to slow things down. But eventually, a lawsuit after months and months or even years will eventually go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think now we have an even more conservative court than we did back in 2016 and 2017. And so it still remains to be seen how all that's going to play out. Bottom line, I should say, though, that like one of the things that I think the reason why I think public officials do what they do, especially here in Hawaii, is because we are a system of checks and balances. And we do have laws and we do have a constitution that's in place. So it's not like these are just political moves that are being made in order to stop whatever the opposing party is doing. It's lawyers who are saying, look, this is what our constitution says. This is what our law says. This is what case law has said for decades or centuries about this topic. And so when we're filing these lawsuits to stop it, it's because we're relying upon this history and this case law that has brought us to the point where we're at now.
We often look to lawyers to help us think clearly about these issues. It's just that right now we're just being bombarded with so many different issues, critical issues, but at one time it's hard to keep straight.
Right. So I do think without question the pace is happening very quickly. But I'm also impressed with how the different states, including Hawaii, have been able to react to what's been happening and to choose the lawsuits that they're choosing in order to be able to take a stand. Because, again, it's one of those questions. If you allow the government to infringe upon our constitutional rights or the protections that we've had all our lives, if you allow them to do it in this one area, then what stops it from the next step after that? And I think that's the concern that many people, including myself, have.
You know, we had on the current State Attorney General, Ann Lopez, you know, on the show last week, and she talked about, this is our battle for our generation.
Sure.
You know, we've got to think clearly about how are we strategically going to argue these cases because there are so many, it's so many different levels.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I think that's so important. I mean, one of the things that's really hit me is how when I was growing up in high school or when I went to college and went to studied U.S. history or then went to law school and studied constitutional law, we learned a lot of different principles about the First Amendment and about the 14th Amendment and about how all of these are meant to promote equality and the values that I think a lot of Hawaii people sign on to. So I think to see these lawsuits play out is really important for this generation because it could be changing how we're learning about how the U.S. operates or how the U.S. actually thinks about these different issues, especially if the U.S. Supreme Court starts reversing decisions or turning over case law that's existed for now centuries.
It seems like right now, more than ever, people need to pay attention to what's going on.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think for a lot of people where the election didn't turn out the way that they wanted to, there was a bit of a shutdown where everybody said, no, I don't want to read about this or hear about this. But we're in it right now. You know, we're living the second Trump administration. And so now is the time to pay attention because as the courts rule, that is going to have an eventual effect upon all of our lives or even on our kids' lives.
Yeah, I mean, I just think of the number of people in my circles that have been affected by a number of these executive orders. And it's stunning. It's just like, whoa. It's interesting to see, you know, and I don't know if it's the idea that the Trump administration is going after the deep state, but it just seems like, wow, when you think of all the public servants that are being affected by these decisions,
right.
It's just stunning.
Yeah, it's without question, it's destabilizing. And I'm sure there's a portion of the population that thinks, well, this instability is good. I don't think so. I think, if anything, the reason why we've had the government and the system and the checks and balances that we've had for so long is because all of those things taken together, as messy as it is, it still protects us and helps us to be able to make sure that our own individual rights are being watched out for.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming down and sharing your time with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And that was former State Attorney General Doug Chin, who was recalling the lawsuit filed over the Muslim travel ban under the first term of Donald Trump as president. We talked to Chin in our studio early this morning.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
President Trump is promising to end the now three-year-long war in Ukraine.
I think I have the power to end this war, and I think it's going very well. But today I heard, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal.
But with Ukraine sidelined from talks about a deal, is peace even possible? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
The media landscape is shrinking, not only across the country, but the trend is also noticeable in our high schools. Today, HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio joins us in studio to talk about what she's seeing in our public and private schools. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what did you look at?
So I looked at 45 public high schools in the state, and I found that of those 38 schools that got back to me, less than half said they have a student newspaper, which is a very stark contrast. And of those high schools that discontinued their student newspaper include Pearl City High School and Kaimuki High School. And we're also seeing that not many public schools are participating in the High School Journalism Awards, and there's a number of factors affecting students participating in even journalism programs in the Hawaii high schools. That includes the elimination of journalism as an English credit for several decades, it's been offered as an elective only, and colleges will typically not accept journalism as an English credit, mm-hmm. which could also discourage students from even taking journalism classes in high school. And that's very essential. Journalism classes will offer media literacy, which is very, very much needed today, and along with news writing, which helps students practice critical thinking and researching and fact-checking. Another issue is that journalism isn't even listed in the Hawaii Department of Education's 13 Career Pathways, which is the Career and Technical Education Program. Normally, journalism would be kind of considered the cultural arts, media, and entertainment category, but that category in the CTE program only lists digital design, fashion design, and even film and media production, but journalism was not listed. Advisors have also told me that the issue is that there's been a rise of an interest of STEM programs. More students are interested in more of a steady career income flow, right. Like the medical field and engineering.
So it's the science, technology, those subjects.
Yeah, and that's like the workforce that students are looking at. I spoke with Jay Hartwell, who is the president of the Hawaii Publishers Association, and he says journalism is essential for communities to get their news, and he underscored how the local media landscape has changed in Hawaii.
The theme for this year's High School Journalism Awards is Journalists Change the World. We wouldn't know what's going on in Washington, D.C. or around the country without journalists telling us. Their role is critical for the community's knowledge and for community action, because journalists seem to be the only ones holding government accountable for their actions. But journalism is also local. And so while the New York Times and the Washington Post can afford to cover what's going on, what is happening in the local landscape when there has been reduced staffs, reduced funding, newspapers and TV stations eliminated, there are news programs. Alternatives are coming up. You can look at Civil Beat. You can look at Hawaii Public Radio. There are three new online news entities that have started in this year that are providing people with information. Some of it you can't find anywhere else.
And looking at the public high school journalism awards, getting the data that might have has changed now, 7 public high schools are participating out of the 14 schools in this year's high school journalism award. Again, that number might have changed as people are still signing on or schools are still signing on. But typically the public high schools that participate in the journalism awards are from Oahu. They include Farrington, Kalani, McKinley, Moanalua, Nanakuli, and even Waipahu. And they have advisors for many years that support the program to help recruit students. And then some years, some schools participate and sometimes they do. And the High School Journalism Awards has 22 categories, and a lot of them are submitted by their advisors. But looking, just eyeballing the past High School Journalism Awards, the top award with a cash prize of $200 that kind of alternates every year are mostly from the private schools at first place awards. So the past 2 years, it was actually Sacred Hearts Academy, the all-girls schools, for the past 2 years. And then before that, it was Hawaii Baptist Academy for the past 8 years.
Wow.
So a lot of that, there are some disparities there, but a lot of the public schools have been catching up. I've seen Mililani and Moanalua has placed in the top three for best in the state, and also McKinley as well. But that's because you look at their dedicated newspaper advisors who've been training them in the news writing programs that they have at their schools. I've even looked at the Society of Professional Journalists Internships, that's the Hawaii chapter, and I got data between 2019 and 2024, and it looks that the private school graduates have been dominating the local internship fields here. Hawaii private schools actually accounted for 42% of the finalists in our local SBJ program internships, and then people from the mainland schools accounted for 31% of the finalists, and people from public schools accounted for 20% of the finalist. So that's pretty much that stark difference. I spoke with Dominic Neo. He's a student at McKinley High School who writes for his newspaper, The Pinion, and he said there's disparities in education.
We don't have enough school funds to use it at home, so we often have to spend our own money. Jessica here has been spending most of her money on so we can design it at home because we don't have access to it. We also don't go to the training events, so we often have to figure it out ourselves. Compared to, I believe, some of the private schools have the opportunity to go to the mainland and like learn how this stuff works. We don't have the opportunity to do that. So yeah, those are one of the disparities that I'm talking about.
He's talking specifically about using InDesign. So InDesign is one of those like Adobe, Adobe applications.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of like how we use Audition to weave together our audio pieces. And InDesign's is pretty expensive. There's some schools that do offer it in-house. I talked to Cindy Reeves, they do offer it. But for students who are on those tight deadlines to get the print edition out, Dominic was talking about how they have to pay for it out of pocket at home just to finish their school newspaper. But what I've also found in my reporting that there's been a revival of school newspapers. I just learned last week, I called Lahaina Luna High School. They just revived their school newspaper X amount of years. There was a first student newspaper, or first newspaper in the state was Kalama, and an English teacher was the one who revived it because he saw a lack of media literacy at his school. Right now, they're still trying to get off the ground, and they're still working on their first print edition, but I'll be following up in another story. I also spoke with Brooke Nazar, who's an English teacher and journalism teacher. She said the issue is not so much of a public versus private school, but a matter of which schools are willing to dedicate resources to journalism classes and programs.
When I took over the Kalani news writing program, the previous year, we had no contributions to the Hawaii High School Journalism Awards. In 6 years, we then were third in the state. So how does that happen? It happens because the class is offered, or journalism is offered as a class for credit that students earn a grade for, and you have a teacher who's passionate about journalism. It doesn't mean the teacher has to have worked in journalism before. They just have to be really passionate about journalism and willing to learn in order to teach their students. That's why it happened. So I don't think it's a public versus private thing. I think it's a school choice to dedicate resources to the program. And if a private school dedicates resources to the program, then that student journalism program will thrive. If a public school does the same thing, that student journalism program will thrive, as shown by the program here at Kalani. But if those resources aren't being prioritized for journalism, then at a public school or any school, private or public, the program isn't going to go anywhere.
So we're also seeing that newspapers, even though they are declining, they're also moving to an online platform.
Yeah, interesting to see all the changes. But thank you so much. This was really fascinating.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HBR reporter Cassie Ordonio about a story looking at the decline of school newspaper programs here in the islands. Check out her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
In his epic composition, The Lightbringer, Hawaii Symphony composer in residence Michael Thomas Fumai portrays an epic battle between good and evil. Tell me, what was the genesis of this piece, The Lightbringer?
Well, this is a piece that really starts with the title, The Lightbringer, and it has to do with the devil, an unsavory figure in Christianity. And it is something I was always very interested in because I was brought up Catholic and read Revelations and, you know, was kind of trying to picture the genesis of what would become the devil. And so I wanted to write music that really foretold this battle of the angels that we see in that chapter of the Bible. And that's what The Lightbringer is.
Stand firmly on the side of good by supporting 24 hours of classical music each and every day on HPR2. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org to donate.
We now bring you some buzzy news. A new native bee species has been discovered on Molokai. It's one of 64 species of endemic yellow-faced bee, Carl Maniaco is the survey entomologist with the Department of Land and Natural Resources, Division of Forestry and Wildlife. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the discovery and what being a professional bug hunter is really like.
The site that I went to is one of these places. It's a little parcel on the south slope of Molokai that the state acquired in 2022 from a private landowner with the help of the Nature Conservancy. And that whole south slope of Molokai, if you've ever flown over it, it's been really devastated. It's had a lot of erosion, but there's little pockets left. And this is one of those. It's a really, really beautiful spot. It's got a ton of native trees, just a real great diversity. When you first see it, actually, it looks a little weedy. A lot of the low vegetation is kind of weeds, but then you look around and you see all the taller trees. There's almost no dominant species, so there's only a few of each one, and every one is different. And then there's this one shrub called Colomona. The scientific name is Senna gaudishiodii, and it's one that I think used to be much more common. It's known from all the islands, but I had actually never seen it. And it was one of the few things that was flowering. So I looked at it, and there's a number of bees flying around it. And that wasn't too surprising. And I caught some that I recognized as some of the, I wouldn't say common, but not super rare species. It turned out I didn't realize those actually hadn't been seen on Molokai in about 100 years. So they're more common on the Maui and the other islands, but those were great finds as well. But then I noticed that, so most of the males have a yellow mark on the face. That's why they're called, the whole group is called yellow-faced bees. That pattern varies, and that's how you can tell the species apart without a microscope. The females mostly are all black, but I noticed as I was looking at them, have a small magnifying lens. One of the ones that was all black was a male, and you can tell they have a different antenna. I knew there's none that are all black from Molokai. So there's only a 4 or 5 in the whole state that are like that. So I knew that was a new one. But I ended up getting no more males that whole time. It turned out there was 2 females of that species.
What goes into capturing these species to then see if they might be new or haven't been reported in a while?
Yeah, that's one thing that, especially when you're talking to mainland bee workers, they don't really understand how different that is, because on the mainland, you come across a flowering bush and you can just sit there with a net and sweep around it and you'll get 200 bees. But here, it's very different. You just have to sit there and sort of stare at the thing that's flowering with the net in your hand. And every 5 or 10 minutes, one bee comes and kind of makes a circle around, or maybe comes and lands on the flower. And if you're lucky, you swing your net, and if you're lucky, you catch it. And if you're not lucky, it gets away, and then you have to wait another 5 or 10 minutes. So it's a very time-consuming thing. And so actually, in my current position, I haven't been really doing much on bees, because if you're looking for them, you really can't look for much else. And a big part of, you know, all of this work is you have to kind of partition your effort, decide what you're going to work on, because a lot of things like the bees and things like weevils, there's things that live in the leaf litter, and those also take a lot of work to get them out. And that some of those aren't even necessarily rare, but if you are looking for them, you're going to spend all your time looking for that, versus if you do sort of more general collecting, you can find 300 species of insects just mm-hmm. around.
And then once you've collected species, what goes into identifying them, or in some cases, if you think it's a new species, getting that ready for publication, making sure that it is indeed novel?
Yeah, so it requires a lot of literature. There's a lot of things that have been published, journal papers, books, monographs, and you have to know a lot of specialized terms for the different parts of the body. A lot of times different groups have, you know, specialized structures that will only be in this, you know, one family or something. But yeah, there's only maybe 2 or 3 other people in the state, I think, that can do the same amount of identification, like identifications across the number of groups the way that I do. And I can't cover all of them. Even I am no good with moths. They drive me crazy.
And why is it important to identify these new species, to have people like you in full-time positions looking, you know, just doing that work?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people will say that, like, what does it matter if this one, you know, fly or beetle goes extinct? And there's a lot of different parts of that. I mean, one thing is just in general in our ecosystems, the whole ecosystem is sort of like a big Jenga pile, and any one piece, you can pull it out and it doesn't really matter much, but you start pulling out a lot of pieces and things start to break down. And especially in a place like Hawaii where, you know, things are kind of different. We have our native species and then we have these invasive things coming in. Things get really difficult, and there can be a lot of interactions that we don't really understand, that we don't even see, really. So we've had, you know, invasive isopods come in and just completely alter the decomposition of wood here. That means we don't have soil, like the soil and nutrients get changed, and then now our native plants don't grow up. And so, you know, right now we don't even have the most basic data on, like, what species are where and what's still surviving, what's abundant, what's declining. This is almost just the very first step in trying to figure out that information. A lot of these species, they were only discovered once 100 years ago, and then nobody's looked at them or seen them make sense. And we don't really know what they do. It's possible some of them, maybe you could say they're not important, but who knows? We really need to get a handle on that. And you don't really want to take a chance on that. And then in general, every species that evolved here is just part of the natural heritage of Hawaii. It's what makes this place unique. You know, we've had 1,000 or more years of human cultural evolution that's made, you know, Hawaii a unique place. And that's what makes it different from Tahiti or the Marquesas or the mainland. And we've had, you know, 5 or 25 million years of, you know, non-human biological evolution that's made Hawaii different from everywhere else in the world. And, you know, I think we really need to protect that and maintain it.
Tell us about the name of this new species. I know you've been doing it a while, but is it cool when you get to name a new species?
Yeah, it is. Sometimes it can be a waiver. So another group that I work on, it's called a Ciaroa. It's a group of parasitic wasps. There's actually so many of them that I'm running out of names. I initially used Latin names for a few of them, and then realized I had too many non-Hawaiian ones, so I needed to save the Latin names for those. I need to use only Hawaiian names, which I generally like to use. It's good practice. But now I'm already starting to run out of Hawaiian names. You like to pick something distinctive and really characteristic, and sometimes there's just not anything that interesting about them in appearance. So this one fortunately happened to have something that was really nice. It, you know, being that all black, which is kind of unusual among the group, it was a really sort of striking thing. So it was good to have a nice sort of inspiration for it.
And so its name is Hylaeus palmaco. I'm just reading from the press release. It can mean mourning or grief, the word palmaco.
Yeah. And like there's a lot of species that are named in Latin are called funebris, which means funeral for species that are black.
I feel like when people see the announcement of new species discovered, it's really exciting and they might think that that is a rare or uncommon occurrence. But you shared that you've actually discovered hundreds of species and might have, you know, even more that have just not been classified or published as such yet. So put this discovery into perspective for us.
Yeah, so I think it comes from probably from our vertebrate bias. So it is somewhat rare to get like a new bird or new mammal. When you're talking about insects, it's a very different story. So there's just so many of them and they're so small and difficult to identify that if you go out and sweep a net, especially, you know, here in Hawaii, if you're out in the native forest, you can get new species pretty much everywhere. I get them pretty much every day that I'm identifying things that I've collected. So far, I've described over 200 native species. That's really just a fraction of the ones that I've actually collected because I don't have the expertise to do a lot of these groups, and I also just don't have the time. Another big part of it is that very few people are actually employed to do the work of describing the species. And so this was sort of a rare one where because it was just one species, it's a really important group and this one is probably endangered. you know, I was able to do it on my work time, but I got 500 species or so that I've collected as part of this work just in the last 2 years. And that's going to take years to describe, and it's not really part of my job. I actually have described over the past 8 or so years, done about 150 species just on my own time. And that's how a lot of insect species get described, just people working on their own.
Oh, and I always wonder this about taxonomists, entomologists. Were you always a bug guy, like as a kid?
I was. Yeah, everybody has a different story. But yeah, I have been into bugs since I was 8 years old. And I almost went into the wrong field the wrong subfield of entomology. So when I first came to Hawaii, I worked for 4 years at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park at USGS. And then I realized while I was there that the thing that I actually really liked doing was doing the identifications. And that's what would sort of keep me there late, because I wanted to get to the bottom of cracking the puzzle of what this bug actually was. And it can take a long time. Sometimes you have to sit there with the book. You have to track down a paper, this one paper that's got the answer. And so, yeah, that's how I ended up going into systematics and taxonomy.
Is there anything else about your work or about this discovery that you think listeners might have misconceptions about?
It is very frustrating that every time I, you know, post a picture of a QP, there's always at least one person who's like, oh, gross. And bees are very cool. They're not aggressive. They're very sweet. You have to be gentle handling them, but they're quite nice. And, you know, my wasps, the other wasps that I work on, they're pretty cool. They're also tiny. They're, you know, 2 or 3 millimeters long. And it's like a 16th of an inch. But there's just so many of them. It's so cool. There's probably 500 species of those endemic just to Hawaii. It's a really fascinating group. And yeah, when people think of wasps, they think of, you know, yellow jackets, which they're big and really aggressive, and it really hurts when they sting. But wasps as a group are just an absolutely massive group. There's, well, hundreds of thousands of species at least. We really have no idea how many there actually are. And they do a vital function in keeping the balance of nature. Most of them are parasitoids. They kill caterpillars that would otherwise just completely defoliate all our plants. And some of them actually attack plants as well. And, you know, they control weeds and things. So, yeah, I love wasps.
We can tell. That was Carl Maniaco with the Department of Land and Natural Resources. We'll have a photo of the newly discovered species, Hylaeus paumako, on our website after the show. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, change is coming for those agricultural forms required for travelers coming into Hawaii. And we check in with our friends at Honolulu Civil Beat. Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.